These violations undermine the rule of law and a representative democracy.
South Korea's president is ousted. It's Monday, March 13th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Be sure to check us out online on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, will talks resume with North Korea? A rights group slams Philippines' drug war. A natural and nuclear disaster anniversary is marked. And something new from an ancient trading route. The trail begins here on VOA Asia. South Korea's ousted former President Park Geun-hye apologized Sunday to her supporters for failing to fulfill my duty as president. Park Geun-hye left the presidential Blue House 2 days after the Constitutional Court issued a verdict removing her from office over a corruption scandal. She arrived Sunday to her private home in Seoul, where hundreds of supporters had been protesting her ouster. Park did not speak to reporters, but a spokesperson read a statement where she reaffirmed her innocence and said, quote, "Although it will take time, I believe the truth will certainly come out," while expressing gratitude for those who supported her. The Constitutional Court on Friday upheld a parliamentary vote to impeach and remove her from office over allegations that a multi-million-dollar influence peddling scandal was being run out of the Blue House. Acting Chief Justice Lee Jung-mi's reading of the ruling from the Constitutional Court in Seoul Friday was broadcast live by national media outlets.
We believe that there are greater benefits by expelling the respondent from the office. Therefore, with a unanimous vote of the justices, we announce upholding the impeachment. The respondent, President Park Geun-hye, is expelled.
The court's ruling also removed Park's presidential immunity to criminal indictment. The court cited as, quote, "grave violations of the Constitution," the allegations that Park colluded with her longtime friend Choi Soon-sil to extort Korean conglomerates to donate more than $69 million to two dubious foundations. Choi was alleged to have a cult-like influence over President Park and control over her staff, even though she had no official governmental role.
These violations undermine the rule of law and a representative democracy.
Park was also reprimanded for being uncooperative and evasive in the investigations. The Constitutional Court also clarified that its ruling was focused on the legitimacy of the National Assembly action to oust the president and not on criminal guilt or innocence. The 64-year-old Park now becomes the first democratically elected president of South Korea to be removed from office. In Myung-jin, interim head of Park's conservative Liberty Korea Party, said his party will respect the grave value of constitutional law and democracy and will humbly accept the decision of the court. He says from this moment, the Liberty Korea Party is not a ruling party anymore. Chu Mae, leader of the opposition Democratic Party of Korea, hailed the court ruling as an historic triumph of people and power and democracy over an entrenched government and corporate monopoly.
The world will record the great fight and victory of our people as new history of democracy.
The impeached president has repeatedly denied the charges against her, maintaining the actions she took were in the national interest, and insisting she never personally benefited during her 18 years of public service. She also offered a number of public apologies for not being aware that some of her close associates may have been involved in some wrongdoings. U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner issued a statement saying the South Korean impeachment decision is a domestic issue on which the United States takes no position, and that the U.S. will continue to be a steadfast ally, friend, and partner to South Korea, especially with respect to defending against a threat from North Korea. The South Korean military has been put on high alert following the impeachment ruling to deter North Korea from taking advantage of the political turmoil in the country. There's more on our developing story on our Facebook page at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories that are trending on voanews.com. South Korea considers constitutional overhaul after Park's ouster. Philippines and rebels to restart peace talks and a ceasefire. State Research Center says China's economy set for steady growth. China's chief justice praises cases criticized in the West. Malaysia says only 315 North Koreans are left in the country. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. While the Trump administration is exploring strategies to thwart North Korea's nuclear ambitions, former U.S. officials who dealt with the communist state extensively offered mixed views on how to achieve that goal. Last week, Pyongyang launched four ballistic missiles in an apparent protest against U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises. Following a U.N. Security Council meeting on the launches, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley said the regime must take positive action before it can be taken seriously. She made her remarks a week before U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is scheduled to make his first trip to Asia, where North Korea is likely to be his top agenda item. Christopher Hill, who served as the head of the U.S. delegation to the six-party talks, which stalled in 2008, raised doubts about the regime's willingness to discuss denuclearization.
I'm pessimistic about talks, but I think we should leave the door open to talks. North Korea indicates no interest in doing away with their nuclear weapons. On the contrary, their interest is in enhancing their nuclear arsenal.
Hill stressed any future talks with North Korea must be based on what the country has already agreed in referring to a nuclear deal in 2005, in which Pyongyang promised to give up its nuclear weapons programs. The envoy called for U.S. efforts to strengthen relations with regional allies and engage China to try to narrow the differences on the North. Critics argue pressure alone would not resolve the North Korea nuclear issue. Robert Gallucci, who was the top U.S. negotiator when the first North Korea nuclear crisis broke in the early 1990s, said the United States should seek an opportunity to engage North Korea without any precondition. He says sanctions would not change Pyongyang's course on its nuclear weapons.
I think the smart thing would be to, at some point, agree to have talks about talks without preconditions, mm-hmm. and then talk about if both sides want to discuss. But I just am opposed to the idea mm-hmm. that we imagine that sanctions are going to be so effective mm-hmm. that they're going to stop the North Korean behavior that we don't like, that, or maybe even that they're going to be so effective that they'll cause the regime to collapse.
Joseph Detrani, who served as envoy for the nuclear talks from 2003 to 2005, told VOA the Trump administration should rein in the North's provocative behavior while seeking talks to try to slow down the country's nuclear development.
I think it's important for North Korea to understand that there are consequences when they violate UN Security Council resolutions and launch missiles, as they've recently did.
Detrani suggests the Trump administration should try exploratory talks with Pyongyang to test if the country has any intention of freezing its nuclear weapons programs. Our thanks to Jenny Lee from our VOA Korean service for bringing us this report. Happening now in Asia, South Korea media say a new presidential election might take place May 9th. The election must be held 60 days after the Constitutional Court's ruling on Friday that upheld a parlimentary vote to impeach and remove then-President Park Geun-hye. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Philippines police are being accused of falsifying evidence to justify the roughly 8,000 deaths in that nation's anti-drug efforts, according to a hefty 117-page report just released by the New York-based Human Rights Watch. Philippines presidential spokesman Ernesto Abella denied the allegations in the report, saying the rights organization needed to, quote, do its homework more diligently. President Rodrigo Duterte responded to the report by saying, when you kill criminals, that's not a crime against humanity. VOA's Steve Miller spoke with Human Rights Watch Deputy Asia Director Phelim Kine about the findings.
What Human Rights Watch research on the Philippines Duterte quote-unquote war on drugs reveals is that the government's and the police narrative that the vast majority of those Filipinos who have been shot dead on the streets of Philippine cities over the last 8 months, all to a man, woman, fought back, simply isn't true. Human Rights Watch, you know, exposes the falsity of that narrative and has revealed, number one, that in numerous cases, police were directly involved in planting evidence on suspects who have apparently been unlawfully executed by police. And that evidence included small sachets, bags of methamphetamine, weapons like handguns. And in other cases, we determined that incidents which the police describe as killings by quote-unquote unidentified gunmen were in fact killings that had the direct knowledge, if not the actual involvement, of police personnel. So the government's narrative that what is happening is something that is a lawful approach to crime control is simply wrong. What we have is a human rights calamity.
Following the death of a South Korean businessman, the police were taken off the anti-drug operations and recently resumed that. And in three operations on Tuesday, four people died. What does your report say about what needs to change to prevent further deaths from taking place?
What needs to change is the government needs to call an immediate stop to this so-called war on drugs. And it needs to allow an urgent, impartial, independent international investigation of these killings. We are asking for an international United Nations-sponsored investigation because it's clear to us, given the evidence of the last 8 months and the evidence of our research, that neither the Duterte government nor the Philippine National Police are willing or able to adequately investigate themselves. And this requires outside investigators to, number one, determine what happened. Who were these people who were killed, these 8,000-odd Filipinos, and what were the circumstances of their deaths?
If we take this down to the street level for the average Filipino, will reports like this, because the killings in the Philippines have been well documented since last June, will reports like this bring about any effective change in the immediate future?
Our report has two key goals, and that is to motivate international pressure and international action, but also it's to send a message of support to those groups and individuals in the Philippines that are seeking to push back and to change things within their own society.
Felim Kine is the Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch in New York. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is enjoying his party's landslide victory in the politically crucial northern state of Uttar Pradesh, a huge boost halfway through his term. The Election Commission says that his party has more than 320 seats in the 403-member state assembly. All the big stories come your way throughout the day. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, Saturday marked the sixth anniversary of the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl, after a magnitude 9.0 earthquake triggered a 15-meter-high tsunami that disabled the power supply of the coastal Fukushima Daiichi power plant in northeast Japan, interrupting the cooling of three reactors. That tsunami caused nearly 19,000 deaths and forced 160,000 people living near the plant to flee. The plant's decommissioning and cleanup is expected to take up to 40 years at a cost of nearly $190 billion. Australian diplomat Richard Broinowski, who wrote the 2012 book Fallout from Fukushima, tells VOA's Victor Beatty after 6 years, the cleanup directed by plant owner Tokyo Electric Power has barely begun.
What they have done is to take the fuel rods out of the swimming pool storage tank on unit number 4. That is one unit that was closed down at the time of the tsunami, so it didn't melt down. But the tank was very perilous because it contained 1,300 fuel rods and quite a lot of fresh fuel rods as well. And if that had fallen over and the conditions had been right, it could have meant that Tokyo would have to be evacuated. So they've done that. What they haven't done, Victor, is to get into the 3 reactors that melted down and find where the hundreds of tons of molten, highly radioactive rods are. And yes, there have been some robots they've tried to send in. The Japanese are ingenious making these things, but they failed because of the high levels of radioactivity. A conservative estimate would say it'll take 30 to 40 years more before they've even begun to get close to getting rid of the melted down material in the reactors. Meanwhile, they're building this wall of iced water on the landward side of Fukushima Daiichi, which is meant to provide an impermeable structure to stop the leaked groundwater from getting back inland, but it still goes out to sea.
What has life been like after the Fukushima disaster for people that lived near the nuclear plant?
About 100,000 people were evacuated. There are about 60,000, I believe, who are still unable to come back. There's a lot of wishful thinking, especially on the part of the nuclear industry in Japan, saying, oh, look, we're cleaning things up, it'll be all right, you can come back. But most people won't come back. Come back to what? Their villages have all been destroyed. They've been leveled. A lot of the radioactivity in the ground has been bagged and put in plastic bags in huge serried ranks across the landscape. And there's nowhere for them to go. Meanwhile, I've seen a figure about 166 young kids have got cancer of the thyroid. I think most of them, if not all, have been cured because that's a comparatively easy cancer to isolate and excise. But it shows that it's by no means a healthy environment for people to come back to.
There were 54 nuclear power plants that at one time provided the country with a third of its power. Mr. Broinowski says only 3 are online today. He says other countries like China are careful about where their nuclear facilities are built while they focus on more renewable sources of energy. Developing at this hour in Asia, officials in Pakistan say arrangements are in place to conduct a national census for the first time in 19 years beginning Wednesday. More than 200,000 troops will assist civilian enumerators in collecting the data in 2 phases, a 70-day door-to-door campaign. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the ancient trading route known as the Silk Road connected the East and West at least as far back as the 3rd century BCE. Goods and ideas traveled across 2 continents among the greatest civilizations of Asia and Europe. But an interesting new study says a critical middle link over the mountains of Central Asia was paved by the hooves of nomads' livestock. Rather than seeing herders as marginal players, VOA's Steve Barragona finds out this new study puts them squarely at the center of the ancient exchange.
Look up the Silk Road, and you'll likely find something like a highway map, a network of lines connecting cities from Xi'an in the east to Genoa in the west. But in the middle are the mountains of Central Asia.
Yeah, I mean, the mountains have always been perceived as a massive barrier. And that's not for nothing. I mean, they're really big and tall mountains.
Washington University anthropologist Michael Fraschetti says via Skype that these mountains are not much smaller than the Himalayas. When researchers think about how the Silk Road got through that barrier, Fraschetti says they often look for the path of least resistance between cities.
And that makes sense if your destination is the other side. But what if that's not your destination?
Fraschetti has worked with herder communities in the mountains of Kazakhstan. He says for millennia, they have migrated up and down these mountains with the changing seasons.
Their number one priority isn't taking the easiest path. Their number one priority is feeding their animals along the way.
As they travel from pasture to pasture, they meet and trade with other herder communities. These meetings are like festivals, he adds. They're times when goods are exchanged and bonds are formed. Frischetti's previous research modeled how Bronze Age herders may have moved through the mountains of Central Asia from highland pastures in summertime to lowlands in winter, but it had nothing to do with the Silk Road.
You know, and people kind of smiled and said, that's an interesting way of thinking about herding. And that's kind of where it's at. I mean, literally for almost, you know, 11 or more years.
But recently, study co-author Tim Williams at University College London mapped 258 known Silk Road sites. When Frischetti and colleagues lay their map of likely livestock routes over Williams' map of Silk Road sites, they lined up remarkably well.
I think it's a very big deal, and I'll say on two particular fronts.
Dan Rogers is curator of archaeology at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. He says finding how Silk Road traders got through the mountains is important, but the research also changes a perception of the nomads of Central Asia. From ancient Chinese literature to modern movies about Genghis Khan, he says,
nomads are portrayed as bloodthirsty barbarians, essentially. And what we're finding is a much more complicated picture.
Frischetti says it's a picture that pushes back against isolationism.
Through interaction with basically culturally diverse populations, a greater aggregate civilization arose. That's a pretty powerful notion.
Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
We'll stop to graze in our own pastures for a little while until we come back again for another episode tomorrow of VOA Asia. Thank you so much for joining us. You can also download our program as a podcast and take VOA Asia with you wherever you go. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Patrick Dea, and managing editor, Diane Gao, as well as our great VOA Asia team, including Steve Miller and Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
North Korea is an authoritarian state led by the Kim family for more than 60 years. According to the newly released annual State Department Human Rights Report, human rights conditions in North Korea remain abysmal. The government subjects citizens to rigid controls over many aspects of their lives, including denial of the freedoms of speech, press, assembly, association, religion, movement, and worker rights. The government operates a network of political prison camps in which conditions are often harsh, life-threatening, and include forced and compulsory labor. According to the 2015 Korea Institute for National Unification white paper, the Ministry of State Security administered prison camps or Kwanli-so camps. There are reportedly between 5,000 and 50,000 prisoners in each of the five Kwanli-so. Reports indicated that conditions in the prison camp and detention system were harsh and life-threatening, and that systematic and severe human rights abuse occurred. Detainees and prisoners consistently reported violence and torture, and defectors described witnessing public executions in political prison camps. Numerous defector accounts and non-governmental organization reports describe the use of torture by authorities in several detention facilities. Methods of torture and other abuse reportedly included severe beatings, electric shock, prolonged periods of exposure to the elements, humiliations such as public nakedness, confinement for up to several weeks in small punishment cells in which prisoners were unable to stand upright or lie down, among others. Mothers were in some cases reportedly forced to watch the infanticide of their newborn children. Defectors continue to report many prisoners died from torture, disease, starvation, exposure to the elements, or a combination of these causes. The 2016 White Paper on Human Rights in North Korea, published by the Korea Institute for National Unification, and the 2014 UN Commission of Inquiry report stated that officials had in some cases prohibited live births in prison and ordered forced abortions as recently as 2013. Promoting human rights and democratic governance is a core element of U.S. foreign policy, said U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. These human rights reports, he said, demonstrate the United States' unwavering commitment to advancing liberty, human dignity, and global prosperity, including in North Korea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.